Hi, you are listening to the 2014 SLO Conference Podcast. The following recording was made during the second core conversation entitled Television Restoration, Pragmatic Realities and Implications for Media History. Enjoy.
Hi, I'm Paul Steckler. I'm the chair of the RTF department, and 18 years ago, I was incredibly lucky to get a job in this fabulous department. And one of the best things is the FLO conference. I was asked by the faculty advisors, Elisa and Mary, to talk a little bit about the department beforehand. And in the last year, if you take a look at the breadth of the department, and those of you that are RTFers or know about the department, you realize just how broad this department is. We got humanists, we got social scientists, we got screenwriters, we have filmmakers. In the last year, among the production students doing film, we've won first prize at Cannes. With Annie Silverstein's film that beat several thousand films from around the world. We won the first prize of the Student Academy Awards for narrative films. We won the first prize of the International Documentary Association's Student Academy Award. And for social scientists at the ICA, the International Communications Association Convention, the University of Texas, the RTF Department, and the Contra Communication have the most papers of any place in the world. But I think one of the indications about how wonderful this department is every 2 years in FLO, all the people that got their PhDs and are now teaching around the world and around the United States come back here. So if you look around this room and look around the panels we've had and the perceptions we've had, we see just how successful this department is and just what a gem this conference is to be able to bring people back. Elisa and Mary wrote some stuff that they asked me to read. So for those of you that don't know, the FLO conference, which I think is one of the gems of the department, has been biannually held since 2006, making this the fifth conference. And by the way, for the student advisors, this is the best one I've been at. So congratulations, and I'll thank you by name in a second. It's been produced and coordinated by graduate students of the Radio, Television, Film Department with oversight from a faculty advisor or two, Mary and Elisa. The conference brings in the top television and new media scholars, the leaders of the field from media studies departments from around the country and the globe. And it's the first year expanding the roundtable discussions formats that we were known for, to be able to have these core conversations. And for those of you that were here last night for the core conversation, you guys got a lot to live up to.
I'm telling you.
You know, we had David Milch from Deadwood and Michael Zinberg from The Good Wife and Howard Rosenberg and Horace Newcomb back in town to be able to do it. It was just wonderful. So it's a fabulous conference. The RTF department and the conference coordinators were committed to have FLO remain a fixture among our top tier television studies conferences, but that would not be possible without the financial support from a number of people. And so we want to thank the College of Communication, the Moody College of Communication, and especially Dean Hart, who was the person that introduced the panel last in the core conversation yesterday, who's been an incredible supporter of this financially and just in terms of his enthusiasm. We want to thank the Michener Center for Writers and its director, my friend Jim Magnuson, the Graduate School's Fund for Academic Enrichment, UT Press, the Department of American Studies, the Center for Women's and Gender Studies, the University Co-op, Joe Strophauer, a professor in the department, and the UT student government. But that said, the heavy lifting of this would not be possible without the people that have actually organized this conference. I cannot thank the two faculty advisors, Mary Beltran and Elisa Perrin, enough. They've done a fabulous job. But this is a product of the RTF graduate students and the students that have organized this. And I want to thank Nick Bester, Natalie Bogard, Nia Edmondson, Julian Etienne, Charlotte Howell, who did much of the work for tomorrow's core conversation, Jackie Pinkowitz, who did a fabulous job at yesterday's core conversation, Tim Piper and Paul Papil, who did this core conversation. So today's core conversation is Television Restoration, Pragmatic Realities, and the Implications for Media History. And I can't think of anybody better to organize and to moderate this panel than Dr. Caroline Frick. For anybody that's read her book, Saving Cinema, which in part deals with the why and how media has been preserved and how it's affected our whole understanding of film history, or if you've gone to her Texas Archive of the Movie and Image, which is now digitized, I believe 20,000 Texas films and made about 3,000 or 4,000 of them accessible. This is somebody who is an expert in this field. In her spare time, she's the president of the Association of Motion Picture Activists. She's on the National Registry Board for the Library of Congress. And a couple of weeks ago, she won the highest teaching award that you can get at the University of Texas, the Regents Award. It's my pleasure to introduce Dr. Caroline Frick.
Great, thank you so much. And I'm so pleased to see you all here. Welcome. This is going to be a really exciting opportunity for everyone, I can assure you. We have got three guests who are top in their field to talk about one of the most interesting, challenging, on every level challenging, aspects of television, which is we're looking at the issues of what happens when the media artifact, when the television artifact sits and sits and sits some more, and then all of a sudden, they need to get that out in a variety of different platforms. So we are going to be looking at the kind of long life, the life cycle of media artifacts today. We'll be talking about different language. Some people might call it an asset. Some people might call it an artifact. Some people might call it a treasure, right? Some people might call it heritage. We'll be looking at what all of that means in a loaded way. The core conversations, I think, were set up really nicely because they were sort of couched as being the past, present, and the future of television, to pose issues reflecting those particular concerns. What I think is really fun about this particular panel is that while we're sort of in the present, we're really talking about the past and we're really talking about the future all at the same time. Because with new distribution patterns changing virtually every night, the work of the past is the work of now and is the work of the future. So I think that we're poised to take a look at a variety of issues. So I'm going to go ahead and introduce our panelists today. And how we're going to structure this today is we're going to have a couple of presentations. We're going to have then, following the presentations, we'll have a conversation up here, kind of a moderated conversation, and then hopefully throw it open to you all for a pretty substantive Q&A, because I'm hoping that there will be lots of questions. I think we're all hoping there's going to be a lot of questions that you might have about this whole project. So first, I'd like to welcome Professor Derek Comper, who is actually just up the road. He's a friend, just up the road at Southern Methodist University, an associate professor in the media program there. His book, Rerun Nation, I'm assuming has been read by many, many people in this room. And if you haven't, I certainly recommend it. A great look at distribution and the role of kind of revival and reruns in American culture. Really, really great to have you here. We have Ryan Adams, the president of multimedia at CBS Television Distribution.
You just gave me a promotion. I'm the director. I'm the director of operations.
I'll
take the
president. Go with
title,
president
though.
Today. Yeah. Okay? Tweet it, people.
I'm
Let's get it out there.
Back. I'm
going
to take that back to the studio.
Well, that's great. Well done, you. Okay. And David S. Grant, vice president?
Yes.
He got a promotion. Let's talk about that later. We'll talk about it later. He's now your boss. Good luck. David you know. Grant, Vice President of Multimedia at CBS Television Distribution. And as we were spending some time chatting yesterday, I thought that rather than kind of read this boilerplate, and apparently incorrect, bio, instead of doing that what I would ask our three panelists to do is to talk briefly, essentially, about how they got into this. How did they, either from an academic perspective or from an industry perspective, how did they get excited about working in this particular area? And essentially walk us through briefly the career, because I think it can be helpful for a lot of folks in the room to just think about how do careers evolve over time, particularly with this unique approach to archival media. So, Derek, would you like to start?
I think it's on now. Okay, great. Like a lot of things, when you're in grad school, you get interested in all kinds of different things there. And for me, that even started years before when I was a kid, as we were talking last night, you know, watching these old reruns on TV and wondering, you know, what's up with that and how we have this show from this era and this show from this other era and so forth. And I just always had an interest in this, and I thought it was just a general interest in, you know, TV heritage and these old TV shows and things in general. I get into grad school, and I'm thinking there's an interest in that somewhere, but Surely somebody's written a history of this. Surely there's an account of this somewhere about why this is. And turns out there really wasn't. There wasn't really a sort of de facto taken for granted that we have this. And so this just became this path, this sort of detective hunt to figure out, well, when did this start? Why did this start? Why do we have these practices and everything now? And as I got into it, it was just more and more fascinating about how this started. You know, decisions that were made, policies about how are you packaging films together, and are you going to sell those? How are you going to run them every day? Are you going to run them weekly? You know, these sorts of things. And how that evolves over time so that eventually we have things like Nick at Night and beginning in the 80s and DVD box sets in the 2000s and Netflix and Hulu at this point that are they're streaming all these shows. So it's just something that's ongoing and continuous with this. More recently, because of the change in platforms and because of the work of Ryan and David and people like that, how are you migrating these things to different formats, I think, is a big interest now. And you know, we want to be watching these shows for years and decades down the line, theoretically, and they've got to be moved. They're not just going to sit there and it's just going to happen. They've got to actually be physically moved to these new formats. So that's an ongoing interest of mine right now with them.
Hi, I'm David Grant, the Vice President of Multimedia for CBS. My history, I've come from a long line of people in the entertainment industry. I've had aunts and uncles in the business. My uncle was in radio, and way back when, our last name was something different. And for him to be on radio, you couldn't have the last name of Goldstein. So he actually changed the name to Grant. And then my grandmother said, well, if he changes the name, we all change the name. So my name is now David Grant. I've had my mother has worked in the business. She worked on Howdy Doody, if anybody remembers that cartoon. She worked for John Wayne and worked on The Alamo. She worked on NBC's Today Show when it used to be a live show in black and white that went around the world. And that's where she met my father, who was working at NBC. And they got married. And my father went on to work at NBC and then CBS and then retired as the president of entertainment. At a young age, I got hooked. It was in my blood that I wanted to work in entertainment. And I was lucky enough during summers, starting in 1980, to work on a show called The Dukes of Hazzard. And I was a PA on a bicycle, driving around the lot, delivering production reports, call sheets, whatever was asked for me, collating scripts. And that turned into being production coordinator, associate producer. I just sort of followed whatever path was in front of me. I then wanted to learn post-production, so I became an associate producer. I've worked at Skywalker Sound as the head of operations, which is a George Lucas company. I've worked with Jim Cameron and Kate Bigelow on Strange Days, a feature. I was the associate producer. I was the head of 20th Century Fox Archives and helped move those and consolidate those around the world. I've worked at some different production companies, and then Ryan and I were both over at Paramount, and they, Sumner Redstone, the chairman, split CBS and Paramount up, and CBS asked us to come over and start a multimedia department because they didn't have one, and all of a sudden all the TV assets that were at Paramount went to CBS. So what my department does now is we service every department at CBS. Anybody can come to us, and if something needs to look good or sound good, we then do it. If they have sales of Beverly Hillbillies in Australia and it needs to be into high definition, we go back to the old assets, we work with the archives, pull them out, transfer the picture and audio to HD, color it, do sound. Ryan will be doing a demonstration in more detail of all this. We also do social media, oversee 75 classic Facebook pages of CBS older shows, Twitter, Instagram. We work with CBS Films. We do all of their airline editing and TV editing after it is in the theaters. We've got to cut it down for airlines and take all the nasty words out and stuff like that. So it's a fun department to work in because we get to touch a little bit of everything. And every 5 minutes, there's something different. So it's been, you know, it's been a fun experience, but it's been a long career, and you know, I've started at the bottom, which I suggest is the way to do it. So I think without further ado, I will turn it over to Ryan.
Hey, everybody. So I'm Ryan. I'm the director of the department. I wish I was the president, but you know. So what I do as a director is I'm in charge of all the operations, all the creative aspects. But going back to just a little bit of history, I had no, I don't want to say desire, but I had no idea I would get into this business at all. At about 24 years old, I was dating a girl who knew somebody who was friends with this guy, and he needed somebody to come drive film around for 3 days. And I said, well, I got 3 days to kill. So I took a gig for 3 days. I would go out to LAX at 1-2 in the morning and pick up the film from the movies of the week that were being shot in Canada, and I would deliver them to the lab. Well, after 3 days, he kept me on. He offered me a gig, so I started off as a driver. And I would spend my evenings driving out to LAX, picking up film. I would deliver that. But then what I would do is I wanted to learn more once I kind of got into it. So I would ask the editors, the mixers, all the people who were doing what I was interested in. I said, if I keep my mouth shut, can I stand in the back when my shift is over and just watch you guys? So I would do that for a few months. And after a few months, they'd be, hey, kid, come sit up here. So I kind of learned on the job since I didn't come into it with any knowledge whatsoever. And then after a couple months, he moved on and went to that Fox job he was talking about. So I went from driver to helping run the department rather quickly. So he and I stayed in touch all those years. And after I left Hearst Entertainment, I got really fortunate to get offered my first producing gig. So I went to a show called Nash Bridges that starred Don Johnson and Cheech Marin, if you know who those guys are. And I spent a few years on that. And then after that was done, I was fortunate enough to be one of the producers that helped create a show called The Shield for FX. That was with Michael Chiklis and a lot of guys who got their start on that show. And then from there, I was a producer on a show called The District. And then after a couple of years, that show got canceled. And I had a gig lined up, but it was about 8 months away. So I had 8 months to drive my wife crazy because I had nothing to do. And he was at Paramount by this time. So I would call him up and say, I'm unemployed for 8 months. Take me to lunch. You're a studio guy. And he was like, oh, I'm busy. I'm swamped. I'm too busy. Okay.
I didn't want to have lunch. Yeah.
Keep your mic off. It's my turn. So a week later, I was still bored and had nothing to do. So I called my banker, take me to lunch. He's like, I'm too busy. And I said, well, you should get somebody to help you. And we went, hey, I got a few months to kill. So we came in, and he ended up hiring me as a consultant for, it was going to be about 3-4 months at that point. And that 3-4 months has now turned into
about 14 years ago.
So.
So,
you know, that's the thing. You all at least are sitting in chairs knowing what you want to do, so I think it's awesome that you kind of have that passion and that drive. But like David was saying, it sometimes it's great to know all aspects. Like I said, to start at the beginning, I did everything from driving to learning how to be an editor to mixing to all those type of things, which made us be able to create a division that is called, and we had to figure out what we're going to name it because we were doing something in everywhere. It just wasn't restoration. It just wasn't remastering. So he and I came up with the multimedia name of the department because we kind of do anything and everything that anybody asks. And if they call and they ask and we don't know how to do it, we say, of course we know how to do that. And we go find out really quickly and we do it. So just remember that. Always say, yes, I know how to do that. My first producing gig on Nash Bridges, they were switching over to high definition at that point. And they said in my interview, they're like, Ryan, do you know all about high definition? I said, absolutely. Everything. And I went home, and I got on my computer, and it was an old dial-up modem, and I spent a week learning what high definition was. So always say yes. So we're going to show you some cool clips that we brought of some examples of restoration and things that we're doing, and then we'll open up later and chat about things. So let's we can go and run that, and if we can lower the lights, that'd be awesome. So the first thing here is we're going to show some examples of what you're used to seeing when it was aired in standard definition and then when Dave and I went back to the film and retransferred it. And you can really just see just the colors and the detail. You can see the detail in his face and his hair.
Acknowledge, Captain.
Red alert. Again, here's, you know, the difference in the uniforms.
Garon begins his attack, then we will make our move. Excalibur will fall back with engine problems, and you will take the Akagi and the Hornet to this position, which will open a small gap in our detection net.
And at the Romulan...
Even just look at those skin tones.
The Bortas is standing by, sir.
On screen. Garon, this is an unexpected pleasure.
I must speak with you, Picard. We will have to move quickly if we are to be successful.
Successful?
Yes.
Some of them are sad, some funny. Some are stories.
We have some David Lynch fans.
Of violence.
So we were able to find the 16 millimeter that this was shot on was lost for 25 years. So for all these years, you could only see it in standard definition, and we were able to find, with Lynch's help, the original 16. And here again, I mean, just if you look at the high definition, you see so much more detail in the clothing and the leaves and the hair, the curls, her makeup. Yes, this is going back to the original camera negative. So what was used that day on the set that was shot is what we get our hands on. And here, look at his trousers where you see on the left, all the blacks are crushed. There's no detail in them. Going back to that film, we're able to capture and find that detail in his hair and the trees. Before we go on to the second one here, I want David to tell a very quick story. In the beginning, you saw those clips of Star Trek and the difference in the uniform colors, because we got one of the biggest compliments we have ever had came out of retransferring that. David?
One day, as we're working on this, and it's, I think a little bit of it's going out to some of the people that worked on the show, I get a phone call from the associate producer, and I'm like, uh-oh, this is the associate producer that worked on the original Star Trek, and he's calling me. This can't be good. And I pick up the phone, and I said, hi, Robert. And he said, hello. He goes, I just want to tell you something. And I'm like, okay, as I'm clutching my chair.
What did we do?
Exactly. What did we do wrong? And because when we originally put up the negative, the colors were different than anything that had been on previously. And we thought, well, this is what the negative has. We need to go with this. So he says, I want to congratulate you guys. He goes, the colors that you have now are the true colors that we intended 20 years or however many years ago it was. He goes, we were
like
never...
40-something at that point.
Yeah, we were never able to get those colors. We would go to the TV stations, we would go through every transmission, and they were just not able to duplicate the colors on air. He goes, you guys have gotten exactly the way we wanted it. And with that, I said, thank you, you're welcome, goodbye. So.
Thank you. So yeah, we can... Let's move on to the dirt removal process. So this will show you, this will showcase, you know, when you go back to film, obviously you pick up a lot of imperfections, negative dirt, positive dirt, scratches. So on the left, you can see it's just kind of a snowstorm of dirt. And on the right, we go in and clean it up. That was some digital hits that happened on the tape. And there's a hair in the gate. So when you don't clean your gate, you get one of those. And again, here we had tears in the negative. So there's just a couple of quick examples of different things that you run across when you're going back, especially when you're pulling film out. Andy Griffith was, you know, 50-something years ago. So we're going back at times on shows that are 50, 60 years old and pulling that negative that's been stored underground in the salt mines for all these years. And David and I and others like us at other studios, we never know what we're going to get until we open those boxes. You know, we open the box, we put the film up, and sometimes we're very pleasantly surprised, and sometimes we open it up and we go, oh man, what are we going to do? And we go in there, and luckily we have the technology today where we can go in and fix these things.
And sometimes we've been very lucky when we get to go back to the original cartons with the negative that no one's ever done for all this time. We're able to find deleted scenes, makeup tests. We're finding all kinds of stuff that have never been seen before that end up on the DVDs, which is a great value for all the fans that get this stuff.
And the next one we're going to show you is a little something that we do in our department, and it's music replacement. And a lot of times we'll get a show, a couple examples like Happy Days. Happy Days used all these great songs, Chuck Berry, Elvis Presley, all these songs that we know and love, unfortunately we can't afford. We've got cues that, you know, Elvis would cost us $50,000 to get the master in sync, and that's a lot of DVDs you got to sell to recoup that money. So in some cases, we'll go in, and we'll probably talk more about this in the Q&A, but we'll go in and we'll replace music in a series just in order that we can actually give it to the viewers, give it to the people that want it. The consumers are asking for shows, which is why we end up doing them. And we run into these cases, we do whatever's necessary so that we can actually put them on the street. So if you want to run that third one, and we can turn the sound up just a little bit.
And let's start things off right now with a spotlight dance.
Everybody had an ocean across the USA. Then everybody
swim
like California.
And let's start things off right now with a spotlight dance.
We gotta play tonight, so let's
just
try to think of a piano player.
Liberace. Ha, I still got it.
Hot.
Hey, Ralph's gone. I thought I'd do the jokes. Oh. You all right, Al?
Oh, I'm fine. I always warm up like this before I do my piano exercises.
Tonight I came here to rock and roll.
Well, we gotta play tonight, so let's just try to think of a piano player.
Liberace. Ah, I still got it.
Hot.
Hey, Ralph's gone. I thought I'd do the jokes. You all right, Al?
Oh, I'm fine. I always warm up like this before I do my piano exercises.
Ciao, lieto di conoscerti.
Il piacere è tutto mio, Dirk. Kelly è mia nipote,
now,
la figlia di mia sorella maggiore. E credo che lui sia il suo
mix,
nuovo ragazzo.
The dialogue of the music was tied together.
Ryan, ed è un mio collega.
Un collega?
So we went in and actually stripped out George Michael.
Ciao, lieto di conoscerti.
Il piacere è tutto mio, Dirk. Kelly è mia nipote, la figlia di mia sorella maggiore. E credo che lui sia il suo nuovo ragazzo. Come hai detto che ti chiami?
Ryan. Ed è un mio collega.
Un collega?
Ciao. Lieto di conoscerti.
Il piacere è tutto mio, Dirk. Kelly è mia nipote, la figlia di mia sorella maggiore. E credo che lui sia il suo nuovo ragazzo. Come hai detto che ti chiami?
Ryan. Ed è un mio collega.
Un collega?
We can go on to the visual effects, and we'll talk about all of it after the fact.
Space, the final frontier. These are the voyages of the Starship Enterprise. Its 5-year mission to explore strange new worlds.
Now here's a case where not only did we go back to the original film, but we also were able to recreate some of the ships and planets and things that you'll see. So we always try and stay true to the original concept, but bring it up to today's standards.
Sky's the limit.
Then what we've been able to do is on a lot of these shows where we have visual effects and we have all the different film and all the different passes, we go back and recomposite every shot. So every shot will have a light pass, it will have a shading pass, it will have an explosion pass. So all of these different layers of film have to be recomposited together to match the original. And at each stage, there's different lighting and all the visual effects artists have to play with it and get it to look like the original did again.
Going all the way back to that original model.
You can turn up the lights.
I think Derek has
it. Are we going right into it now? I'm sorry. You can turn down the lights.
I just want to say, too, it was nice to see in that reel, that shot from maybe the Trek fans anyway would recognize that shot of the poker table was the last moment of the entire series there. And so that was just to recognize that in some ways is a nice segue to what I'll be talking about in my presentation of how do we preserve these moments and what do they mean? Because obviously it's technical, you know, as they've been talking about. I think that's the most important thing to come out of this, but it's also cultural. And so I'm thinking about how our media texts age, our as in ours culturally, basically, you know, that we enjoy these texts. We want to see whether it's Star Trek or the Beverly Hillbillies or whatever. But they're also ours in terms of CBS's, right? So their properties as well, that you know, they have their assets and they want to sell those as well. So there's a dual meaning with that. The aging in a similar way is it's cultural and material. Like these materials actually physically age. And as we saw with the dirt and the scratches and everything, how are you going to, you know, what are you going to do about that as they age? So let me switch the slide here, see if this is going to work. Oh, back up, there we go. The time that the piece of media that comes from any particular age has a particular kind of resonance about that and everything, and that's always going to be something that's there. So for example, All in the Family, just the video look of it is going to convey the 1970s in a material way as well as in a cultural way. So just as much as, say, Technicolor in the 1940s, 8-bit video games in the 1980s, or oil painting in the 15th and 16th century, for that matter. So there's something about a look that conveys whole, you know, sets of cultural assumptions and things about that. And then I think in your work, as you said with Star Trek, and particularly doing the visual effects and everything, to really, one thing that came up in the extras, if you've seen the Blu-ray extras where they're talking about it, is doing it as if the VFX in the 60s had access to the same tools. You know, basically this is how it would look, to keep, you know, very much in spirit with that. And I think there's an interesting thing to have continuity with that. How we have access to these past materials, though, has been through many different sorts of processes. I want to think about industrially, culturally, what sorts of ways in which we as viewers have accessed past TV. And all along these ways, of course, people that would work on TV have to prepare them and do things differently. So, of course, we've got archival ways of experiencing things. You know, they've got their own sets of practices and resources about that. So, you know, you're going to have a particular set of assumptions and uses of material just as the Paley Center would. Obviously, we've got broadcast. We see reruns off air in various ways, and in Rerun Nation, that was most of what I wrote about, was broadcast reruns. These are examples from recent broadcast reruns. These are diginets or digital subchannels that are awash with reruns now. So actually, the golden age of off-air, off-network reruns on broadcast over-the-air TV is actually now. In our market in Dallas, for example, there's no fewer than 7 national network rerun channels that focus exclusively on reruns. So as these materials come out of the archives and everything, they're repurposed for this. So broadcast reruns is actually a big part of this. Cable, again, as I talked about in Rerun Nation, have been part of building the identity of cable channels. And again, this is something that we have taken for granted for decades now, that there'll be marathons, FFX's, Every Simpsons Ever is a great recent example of something that's been going on for 20 years or so. Reruns have been the bread and butter of the Turner channels, and TBS in particular, going all the way back to when they were WTBS in the 70s, basically showing reruns of Leave It to Beaver and things like that. So this block of reruns on TBS as a big part of their identity and continues to be a big fuel of their ratings, and also for the companies that distribute these shows, very successful for them as well, because it's a ready market for that. Moving more recently, home video, and this is a little bit of nostalgia for you guys. This is the VHS release. The top image there is the VHS release of Star Trek. This is the 1990 edition of this, and then on the bottom, of course, is a Blu-ray release. There's a whole website, by the way, that's just detailing the home video history of Star Trek, which is interesting. And that's part of the story I want to do of not only how things age, but part of how they're aging is part of the history of this. So part of the history of Star Trek, in other words, just to take this one example, is how we have access to that and how every iteration that comes out is going to be accessed a bit differently. And that's fine. I mean, that's part of the history of it, that accumulates over time. So obviously, we're moving from VHS to DVD and Blu-ray. The download era, whether illicitly or through commercial means over the last 15 years, has also been significant. And again, in recirculating materials, building the culture of these materials up, being a ready-made access of data bank for these materials to have, but also beginning with the iTunes store and then just booming out from that as, again, another way to repurpose these materials for commercial reasons. And more recently, streaming as part of this. So you subscribe to streaming service, you have ready access to these old programs and everything as well, right? So every bit of these is different. So even if it's the same text, even if it's the same show, you're encountering it in a different way. It's adding something different to the mix and the way in which you're encountering it and how you perceive it. Okay, so it's very different, obviously, to go to an archive and watch the Andy Griffith Show versus just calling it up on a stream, for example. Okay. I'm not sure where I'm going to go next, but I'm going to find out on this. Oh, all right, this is great. This is what I was telling you guys last night about this. All right, so I was curious about the TV heritage, this idea of a TV heritage with my own students, right? So I asked my students routinely, I polled them on things about what are you watching now, how are you watching things, what kinds of social media do you use and all this. And I got the idea last spring of what shows do you know, basically? What are you familiar with, right? So I came up with this list of series. There's 36 series here, 37. And this is basically representative of things that would have been well represented in reruns over the years, or if you look at the more recent entries, there are shows that I know in recent years have come up with students when I've asked them to list their favorite shows, or things that they've liked, or shows that have been really notable, let's say, over the last decade. And I cut it off at Lost, basically in the mid-2000s, because I wanted a sense of the past, a sense that, you know, they've kind of digested this show and they're familiar with it. Okay, so I presented them with a list of shows, and then for each show I asked them to choose one of these, you know, to best describe their experience with that show. Because I think, and oftentimes those of us who teach, we have this moment in class where we'll make a reference to something, a reference to a particular show that we just assume everybody's familiar with because they've seen this, and it just goes over completely flat because like that moment is passed in the culture where, you know, all of a sudden, no, they don't. They don't actually know, you know, Horshack's laugh from Welcome Back, Kotter, or whatever. And that was a great moment. That was on a podcast, the NPR show Ask Me Another One, where that the host of the show tried to use that as a joke to two contestants who were probably in their early 30s, went right over their head. She said, anyone get it? No? All right, you know, we'll go on. So anyway, so I asked them this, and I've done this with two classes. It's not very scientific. I'm not a real social scientist. I just kind of, you know, get an idea and I just go run with this and do a survey. So this is 95 students, all traditional undergrad age, basically born in the early to mid-90s, upper middle class, about 90% of them born in the U.S., so about 10% born outside the U.S., so slightly different experiences with this, but this is a result of this, and combing this together. And this is where, this is going to break Ryan's heart here in a little bit. Yeah, this is the top five here. So this combines the categories of, basically, if they're pretty familiar with the show, if they've seen several, many, or all episodes of these shows here. So this tells me TBS did really, really well with this generation. Really, really well with that. And the longevity of things is pretty fascinating. So Friends went off the air 10 years ago. It's coming up on its 20th anniversary now. If there's any show on there where I ask students, you know, when I ask them, do you buy things on DVD? Do you binge watch things? That show is, you know, I've had students that watch, they know every episode backwards and forwards. They own all the episodes. And that's just really, really interesting to me, you know that show amongst these others here. But this is where the other ones kind of stack up with this. Now, if we were to go further into the top 10 in this, I Love Lucy, for example, is in the top 10, right? So some of these shows actually that are much older are actually still fairly familiar in good circulation with this. But I think you can infer from this, cable is a big part of this, you know, their access to this when they were children and so forth. And here's the bottom five, right?
Boo.
Yeah, boo, right? So this combines never heard of it, or I've heard of it, I've never seen it. And the Battlestar Galactica, by the way, is a recent one, is the 2000s Battlestar Galactica, right? So this is really significant. So if, you know, and again, this was surprising to me that The Shield was a pretty solid show in the culture when it was on, but it's been off the air long enough, and I think part of it was not streaming available for a while. It took about 5 years to get that up on streaming, and so it fell off the radar completely with that. So I was shocked to see that as a number one show on the list here. Surprising to see Mary Tyler Moore and All the Family in this as well. Both of them have been available, particularly Mary Tyler Moore's show has been on Hulu since Hulu started. It's been there consistently, but it just got pushed off the radar. It's just not one of these things that's there. So again, it breaks our hearts to see some of these in the bottom five, but you know, it was interesting to see that. So again, I'm going to continue to do this, this sort of thing with my students to see what comes up with this. And again, I'll change the shows as time goes by, but I think it's interesting just to gauge where they're at with things. This reveals to me, too, what some of the barriers are and everything. We've encountered this. So for example, my Crime TV class I did for many years, I tried to get them into the Rockford Files, and it just didn't work. So I'm sorry, Jim. I really tried, and, you know, I love the show, and it just went over. They would get into things that were older, you know, Dragnet and The Rookies, they'd be able to kind of, you know, get into, and Rockford Files, they just didn't get, you know, and it was interesting. So there's, what's the cultural sort of disconnect in this? Why are even older things able to communicate, and you know, is it about some other things there? So what I want to finish with is just a couple of other examples of things I'm thinking about with this in terms of versioning, in terms of format migration, because this is all about, it's not only about availability, it's about how do you change things and what happens with this, right? So just a couple of examples to think about. This is one. So I know Friends has come up already with this as widely watched and everything. 20th anniversary coming up, always been massively successful. Along with Seinfeld, you probably know, there's some other 90s shows that have been remastered in HD and basically ported to 16:9. The Friends Blu-ray sets in 16:9. The Friends episodes on broadcast on a cable are in 16:9. The original run of Friends was not broadcast in 16:9, as you well know. It was in 4:3. There's no access to the 4:3 episodes anymore, right? You have to, the last access was those DVD sets. And so this is a case where, you know, going back to those days and when people, when we complained about letterbox films in the 80s on home video and then panning and scanning and this, we have this now where viewers don't want to see the pillar boxes, which are the vertical ones here. Now, a lot of the digital sub-channels will do that. So the older shows, which actually, interestingly enough, aren't in as high demand, they'll still be in 4:3. But because Friends is still sort of current enough and highly rated by cable and the demand is there, the demand is for 16:9. So this changes the text in some way. So yeah, this is the only way we'll be able to see Friends theoretically in the future. And who knows, you know, where those 4-3 episodes are probably archived and everything. They're probably there if you wanted to pull them out. But if you wanted a ready-made access to them, you're going to have to hunt around for them, you know, for a show that's incredibly popular. And again, same thing with Seinfeld at the moment. The other example is of Doctor Who. I've written a little bit about Doctor Who on DVD. Long-running British show, of course, just turned 50 years last year. They've been restoring this in DVD since 2000. They just finished earlier this year in releasing this in a piecemeal fashion, not in season box sets, but taking every individual story and doing the whole nine yards with this, basically all this restoration and everything that goes in with this. So a lot of the same sorts of things that David and Ryan had shown there, every one of these releases, because again, they're dealing with materials from the 60s, 70s, and 80s in terms of refurbishing. Now this isn't for HD, this is for standard definition, because most of this was shot on 625 line video, so they can't really convert up to HD, but this is for standard def, again, just for DVD. But what they're also doing with this is adding a lot of cultural history, a lot of cultural heritage to this. So commentary tracks with directors and writers and actors, whole layers of subtitles of information text, which are not only informative about, you know, they shot this at 6 in the morning in, you know, at by the King's Cross train station or whatever, but also containing little in-jokes and things like this, extra documentaries they'll make about this, and even including vintage media. So this is, every release is kind of like, here's a bit of British TV history from this moment there. So in some ways this is great. This is a good way of taking the historical context and broadening it out, right? But the downside of it is if these are the definitive versions, these are the definitive versions for a generation that grew up with the show at that time. So in other words, these are produced by middle-aged white men, essentially, guys like me, except British, who were fans of the show growing up, and you know, locking down this version of it. So the in-jokes are all in-jokes that you would get if you were a kid from the 70s, right, and understand these references. People are discovering Doctor Who all the time, including the classic episodes. And so again, my concern with locking in a version is, does that then freeze out later interpretations of it? You know, can we do another version? People that came into the new series that started in 2005, if they want to go back and do another version of this from a legitimately different direction, that would be sort of difficult to do, because we sort of locked in this particular interpretation of the show and version of it. So that's something I'm interested in iterations of these texts as they get migrated into different sort of formats there. But again, just to wrap up, we're always going to have this. We're always going to have these texts around. We're always going to be able to have them in some sort of form, whether they're locked away, whether we have access to them, whether they're going to be repurposed or refurbished or restored in some ways. And that's something to hold on to, as in the last episode of the Mary Tyler Moore Show here, or in the last moment of Star Trek The Next Generation, these moments that kind of linger and stay with us in some ways. But, and the but is, they're not always going to linger and stay with us the same way forever. The cultural resonance is going to shift, even though the text is going to be the same there. How that matters, how that moves through history as the different versions come out and the different ways we look at it are going to shift. And so I think that's where my interest is at this moment, where, you know, where that gap is acknowledged and how we understand it. So, thanks.
Well, thank you very much for the presentation. We'll go ahead and move chairs here. I feel like we need to keep that Rockford Files image up there just to kind of over our shoulders, because that look captures, I think, a lot of the feeling of confusion, maybe feeling a little perplexed as to where all of this is going to go. I think a lot of things were brought up in both of these kind of overviews and presentations. And one I think is interesting, as soon as you said, well, they'll always be around, my immediate reaction was, oh, no, they won't. No, they won't. So which is interesting, kind of, because I'm not convinced that that's true. We're talking about a pretty short time span, and if you look at early silent film, the statistics of loss do not connote that we'll actually have that same kind of survival rate.
And, well, I mean, you don't even have to go back to silent film to have that kind of loss. You know, as you guys probably know better than we would, in terms of even material that's only, you know, 20, 30 years old or so. If you kind of go back and try to find the camera negatives, you're lucky in those cases that they took the care, you know, to have that. And that may not always be the case if it's something that the production company goes under and you know, the rights are kind of in this murky kind of place that maybe those materials
even
are gone,
to the point so. Where. Going back in during the 80s, they got in the habit of sometimes when syndication was coming in and they needed syndication prints, they took the original camera negative and they cut it up and they made the syndication prints. They needed 3 minutes out or 5 minutes out, and they cut it out of the original camera negative, which then forces David and I to go back to inferior prints and work our tails off to make them look as good as they can. But that original camera negative that was in the camera is cut up and it's no longer complete.
Sometimes we'll have to go and find the 16 millimeters or the prints, because back then there was no streaming, there was no other markets. It was syndication, and that was it. So they thought, what does it matter? We'll cut the negative. And yes, trying to find lost material all the time, especially on Star Trek Next Generation, where they may have used a visual effect that was in episode 3, but then they used it down in 59. They made no notes. So now we're scrambling to try to finish a season of it, and we can't find that visual effect. And hopefully they did notes, but they never thought even. I mean, they did a great job cataloging, because we found about 99% of everything. But easily, we go back into the archives and can't find things, or we go back to the original camera negatives, and they've sat so long that, you know, they're turning to vinegar.
Well, I thought... So we're talking here a little bit about the granular level of the material artifact and finding it. What do you find at that point? I thought we would talk a little bit about the issue of ownership, the issue of the loaded term, and this is my obsession, is the utilization of the term heritage and your utilization of the term our, right? This is our television heritage. Star Trek is our heritage. I'd like to throw that back to CBS. And say, when you're in meetings, do you think that, what's your reaction to how Star Trek is discussed? Using that as an example, is there a cognizance that it has, outside of the commercial value, that there's a cultural value to the product, so to speak?
I think absolutely, and Ryan and I think are pretty good examples of that. With Star Trek Next Generation, we had gone around with the original Star Trek, and we had gone to Comic-Con, and we had gone to the Star Trek convention, and people loved it, but they were like, Next Generation, we need Next Generation. We want it on DVD, we want it in high definition. So Ryan and I spent many, many years within our own company convincing the company that they needed to do this for the fans, for the product, to keep it moving forward, so it's not only sellable, but fans can see it in a better format. We finally found the right people who... And, you know, it's a good thing we have new ways to distribute things, because the president of digital distribution said, I can cover, and the cost to do Star Trek Next Generation was gigantic. He said, I can cover this, you guys remastering this whole thing, in my Netflix deal. Because when I sell it to Netflix, I will cover. So we were able to get an approval for it, which can be very hard. But yes, we are constantly pushing, and we're now like Deep Space Nine and other shows that we are constantly going to the higher ups at CBS going, you got to come out, you got to do something with this show. We got to do something.
And even to speak even more to the heritage point of it, as Dave and I have been really cognizant of going to the fans, the ones who we're doing this for, and saying, what is it that you guys want? You know, the whole thing of original aspect ratio came up. So with something like Star Trek, the original series, well, we're going back to the film. If we wanted to, we could have done a 16:9. But we went to the fans, and they were like, no, don't mess with the original aspect ratio. We want it 1:3:3. We want a 4:3. So our release of it was 4:3, because that's what the fans wanted. Same thing when it came time to, you know, refurbishing and giving a facelift to the visual effects. We went to them and said, okay, do you want us to get crazy and reimagine this? And they're like, absolutely not. We want what we had. Just make it look good. So we really do listen to the fans. And like David said, when we go to Comic-Con and places like that, we spend time with them and go, okay, here's the questions that we have before we go do it. And then not only the fans, but the directors. David Lynch, when we did Twin Peaks. Well, David and I are certainly not going to make a creative choice on a show like that when a genius like David Lynch is the one who did it. So we would go to Lynch and go, okay, in this situation, A, B, or C, what do you want to do? What do you want us to do on your behalf? So, yeah, we take that very seriously.
And now also that you just reminded me, with social media and us overseeing about 75 classic pages, we will do polls and we will do stuff like, do you want a best of charm? Do you want a this? Do you want that? And we will have fans vote. And then that will tell marketing and stuff, well, look at, they want this, this, and this. Let's do it.
I find that exhilarating and terrifying. It's like, I have no comment to Charmed at this point. Before we go further, I'm serious. Let's just forget we discussed this. Just as a totally not related, but kind of related, could you just maybe tell us a little brief snippet of working with David Lynch and when you were out on a break, what he was asking you? This is important.
Yeah.
This is important.
There's many stories. David Lynch is a wonderful person, obviously a huge creative force and brilliant. Very eclectic, as we all know. And one day when we were working on the new Twin Peaks high definition release, which is out right now, we're just sitting there and he was having a cigarette and he turned to me and he said, Andy Kaufman, dead or alive? I said, I'm going to go with dead, David. What do you think? And he's like, I'm going with alive. He always wanted to fake his death. And, you know, I think he's alive. I said, great. Maybe he's with Jim Morrison and all the rest, you know. And you just kind of flow with it. I'm sure Ryan's, we've got many stories.
Well, I love the man. I was a fan of his before I ever got the opportunity and the chance to work with him. So I was just humbled to be with him. I mean, all the meetings, David's, David was saying, Lynch is a bit eccentric. So we would actually go up to his house for meetings. He doesn't like to go out. You know, he'd rather have people come to his house where he's comfortable, which I loved because we would go up there and drink lattes and eat chocolate croissants, and we would have our meetings at Lynch's house, which, you know, for me as a fan was amazing. But the care that's one of the great things, too, is not only as a studio are we looking for that heritage respect of it, but even someone like David, who this is something he did so long ago, and he's on to so many more things, but the love and care that even the talent that we have the opportunity to approach and deal with. At Paramount, we had a really huge time with this because we would always go back when we remaster, like Braveheart. Well, we're not going to make the decisions on how that looks. So we would bring in the DPs. We would bring in, you know, the Calebs. And we'd bring in all these guys who have won Oscars for these things because these guys certainly know better than he and I do. So we go back to the talent. So from David across the board, working with talent is just, it's awesome. So, yeah, you know, talking about going and trying to find things, you know, we were able to pull the negative back, but we got into Twin Peaks and we're like, okay, what are we going to do? We're missing bits and pieces here and there. So we went to David and David's like, I got a closet up at the house that has boxes in it. So this David and I, we went up to Lynch's house and threw our jeans and t-shirts and tennis shoes on and got on our hands and knees and dug through this closet and actually found, not only that, but I'm digging through and I'm finding boxes that say Blue Velvet and The Elephant Man and, you know, Wild at Heart and these movies that, you know, I was a fan of. And then we also found what we were looking for. So, you know, we really do when it comes to going back and remastering, we don't leave any stone unturned. I mean, I think that was the deepest that we've gone is crawling around in a director's closet. But
there were some freaky props in there. It'd be a mannequin head and I'd be like, oh, geez.
Well, Derek, how do you feel about, kind of from your scholarship, and when you think about fans driving projects and how we end up, in terms of your project, and you know, what shows do end up in circulation? How does that impact your scholarship?
That's a great question because, you know, in the case of, you know, Twin Peaks, great fan base for that, and Star Trek, obviously, with that. But a lot of these other shows, I'm sure, you know, there aren't people, fans beating down the door, you know, in the great numbers, or even fans that you could directly ask about that. So it does kind of privilege the shows that have that if you're able to do that. But I guess that's a case of you really want to get that right, you know, or close to that, you know, as close as you can if there's that fan base to do that. And with other things, I guess it is sort of protecting that idea of heritage, right, in a broader sense. Like, okay, maybe this doesn't have, you know, the immense appeal that this other show does, but we still want to do it right. We still want to have it, you know, in this kind of format and make sure that it's available in there. Or at least, you know, we've preserved it now in this format so that it'll still be here years from now to have in these other sorts of formats. So, yeah.
And, I mean, we were talking about it last night, but with the whole digital, now everything's digital. They're shooting on digital. We don't know how long digital lasts. We make at CBS all the productions not only deliver their digital, they have to deliver at least a tape backup, an HD backup. We had a show that from a production company that delivered a season, delivered it all on files, And they were just going to accept it at the archive. And we said, no, we need the whole thing quality controlled and need tape backups. It was a good thing we did, because we found on many of the episodes it was missing chunks. And if we had just accepted the files and put them in the archives and the production company went away, years later we'd want to come out with it and wouldn't be able to. So it's a bit of a scary thing we're getting into. Nobody knows how long a digital thing lasts.
And that's a challenge, I think, these days. And I'm sure you guys talk about it all the time. But, you know, back with the shows on film, you had the camera negatives. I mean, there's a physical thing. If you preserve it right, it'll be around for decades. But as the digital changes, you know, so much and everything, and the degradation, as you said, you won't have the equivalent of the camera negative, you know, in 50 years from now, to have that around to be able to use, right? So
I could see some black market and a guy with a trench coat saying, you know, I've got a digital file, and it's the full digital file, and I'll sell it to you for...
But even our HD assets, we have things that are several months old, and these HD tapes, every now and then we'll put them back in to look at them, and they've got channel conditions, or, you know, they get dropped or they get hit, and it screws with the packing. And I mean, so it's a terrifying time of asset protection.
Well, and there's the term asset protection. I'm gonna come back at this, because I think this is very Pollyanna. I mean, this is very Pollyanna, saying that CBS views their assets as cultural heritage, maybe in Star Trek, but I was joking that maybe this entire panel would just be David and Ryan responding to their emails, because just in the last 24 hours, you should hear what I'm hearing, right? They're going, you know, Germany wants fill in the blank, or such and such wants this. Who else do you deal with besides the David Lynch, besides the creator? You must be dealing with press. You must be dealing with marketing, other aspects of essentially the corporate bureaucracy. And I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about that. There's always going to be those shows that are going to be the high profile, really sexy ones with the kind of the auteur behind it. But what about your average run of the mill, dare I say, Walker, Texas Ranger?
That is actually...
There is nothing run-of-the-mill about Chuck Norris.
That is actually a huge show, miss.
I know, and that was my plug for tonight's screening, because, yeah, you will be seeing some of that tonight. I'm just throwing that out there. Chuck Norris, delightful. Yes. But continue on.
We were lucky enough to deal with PR and marketing and stuff, because as soon as... And a lot of these places go out to their territories around the world and say to your territory, what do you want to see? Italy loves Happy Days. England loves Star Trek. But they'll go out and see what shows they want. Dr. Quinn, Medicine Woman. And they will come to us in this process, and we work with marketing and stuff to say, okay, first, do we have the stuff? Can we get it to these markets that are interested? What kind of financial stuff are we looking at? And all of the bureaucracy, and what kind of bid would it take to bring it into HD? Would they, that department, make a profit? But we constantly work with, and then we do, when we do restoration things, there are so many sites that, you know, want to then talk to us about, you restored December Bride or something. And it's like, you know, how did you do that, and want to talk about it? So, yeah, we are constantly, we actually have a department now that has been tasked with, let's go into the real old archives of things that people have never heard of or are not asked for, and let's try to bring them out and sell them. So one department is hitting us constantly with shows that, I mean, I've never heard of, and we're trying to make sales and restore them.
Wow, that's exciting.
I was going to add to that as well, just to think about, you know, again, but in terms of assets and sales and everything, and obviously that's important, because that's the business, you know, that's part of it. But for so many shows that might not even have that, right? You know, and that's where the loss of the heritage comes in. And what we've been talking about so far are shows that have a national and even a global presence and everything with this. If you were to go back and as I'm sure you know, you've seen with the archival work in Texas, if you want to do a history of local television, that's really difficult to do. I mean, most local TV stations will have bits and pieces of their past, and some you may be lucky that they've got somebody who actually, you know, cares about that, or, you know, and wants to have archival control over it. So many stations, again, because ownership changes and everything, and it is clean house and all this, and they lose the people that would have cared about that sort of thing, and so local histories, you know, aren't going to be preserved. There's not going to be that commercial, you know, interest in everything to have that, and that's part of the heritage that goes away. And again, you don't even have to look that far back, even if something is fairly recent. If there isn't something to protect that and to have that around, they're not going to keep that around. You know, they're just not going to have that. So, you know.
Well, I would say before we open this up to the group here, I'm curious if you all would perhaps address one of the biggest challenges you faced, whether in terms of doing research on television history or in terms of the work that you're doing in restoring, remastering work, just kind of an anecdote maybe of what your biggest challenge might have been.
I'll start because it's easy. I can answer this one real quick. The hardest thing that I face is getting everyone to approve me to do what I want to do. I want to throw everything I can at these things and remaster them to the to the utmost. I want to spend extra time on dirt cleanup. I want to spend extra time in color, do all these things. But I've got to remember that I have bosses who have to sign off what I'm going to spend and what I want to do with things. So for me, I fall into that category where, especially when I'm working, anything that I work, I mean, there's certain things I'm more passionate about. But once I kind of get into anything and you have... you have this living, breathing entity in your hand, a television show that people are going to see. You want it to look the best that it can. So I can get carried away sometimes and want to do too much.
And then I will be the one telling Ryan, you've only got this much to spend.
It's ridiculous.
Because then I have to work with every department at CBS that wants whatever they want. They, of course, want us to do the cost for the least amount that we can do it for, so they can make the most profit because we have shareholders and blah, blah, blah. And I want to throw, as same as Ryan, as much at it and make it the best it can be. And we sometimes always find creative ways to get what we need done or what we feel needs done. But it is, the constant thing is, it's the politics. And it's, I understand it all, and of course, but it is going back and forth with these departments and saying, no, this is, what we can do it at. Because I'm in the middle of, wow, if I give them a price and it's too much, they're not going to come out with it. The fans aren't going to get it. But I can't go so low because I've got a whole thing that has to be done and it's got to look good. So it's tough.
But I must say, though, we are pretty fortunate in the fact that we do have upper management that does listen at CBS. I mean, CBS, we kind of are known, and pat us both on the back for a second, CBS itself is known to have some of the best restoration out there, and it's because guys like us that are passionate about it, but we do have bosses and higher-ups who recognize that you do need to go put your best foot forward. So we do have that. It could be a lot worse, let me tell you that. We do have people who do listen about what does need to happen, and they're pretty cool about it.
Mine's actually really similar to that, actually. I there's things I wrap my head around about are we worried enough about this, or is this something that's kind of temporary with this? And philosophically, I'm still trying to wrap my head around it. But things I worry about are, do people know that the physical media objects that all of us media scholars rely on, we may not have access to those, at some point. And it may be just an arbitrary decision. Our dean, several years ago, just made like a decision to take out all the VCRs from the kiosks, right? So nobody's using VHS anymore. Those are gone. And the people that were like, well, wait a minute, what about this thing that I show that's only on VHS? And in this case, it would have been like an educational film or something from, 1986, but it was still useful and it was still there. And this is something that had never been put on DVD and whatever in this. And then legal says, well, we can't make a digital copy of this for whatever reason and everything. But you took our VCRs away, so we can't use this. So I think within our educational institutions to think about how we use our materials, what we have access to, those sorts of things. So that's a part of it. But then the philosophical side is, well, is this going to be as big a deal or not in some ways? Is this sort of a holdover? I don't want to be an analog kind of fetishist, of like we must hold on to the material object. But I want the access, though. I want the ability to have that. And so it's sort of, in some ways, I sound alarmist with this and telling people, hold on to that Blu-ray or that DVD because it's not going to be here tomorrow. I tell people with DVD box sets, by the way, for TV shows. If you want that show, get it. If it's on Blu-ray, get it because, you just don't know, right? I mean, they may say with Blu-ray that may be the end of the line, right? And at some point, those are going to go out of print. Not Star Trek, right? And there's going to be things that for the foreseeable future won't. But there's going to be things that went into production 10 years ago or so on DVD that are just out of print now. And so it's a thing. You can't always rely on it being there, basically. And that's the anxiety right now that I worry about from a scholar's and historian's perspective on that. So.
Did you want to comment on that? No, I totally agree with that. That's, we use that word asset protection exactly for that. So hopefully those the masters that create those Blu-ray releases and those things, hopefully those are being looked at and, you know, taken over to the next step and the next step and the next step from there.
And a lot of times our migration of the stuff is dependent on if a sale happens, then we go back to the negative and we are making an HD and maybe we make a standard def conversion. So some of our migration and keeping archives is based on the sales that we do. I wonder the same thing. When is DVD? You know, we keep hearing sales are declining. And when will that go away? Because now streaming services are offering all the extras. So iTunes, you can get the extras that you could only get on a DVD before. So what's, you know, and then streaming, where that's just out there in the cloud. And
that's actually, this reminded me of a point I was going to ask here. I mean, and I will do the Q&A in a second here, but that was reminding me of, because I'd read anecdotally in the trade press about the production budget given to DVDs and Blu-rays in terms of the extras. The budgets for that has actually gone down as the margin's gone down in the sale of the physical objects. And so, yeah, there's some extras available on the download, as you said, from iTunes or from Google or whatever. But streaming doesn't provide that, right? And so, again, that's another one of these assumptions that people sort of assume because the DVDs have all these other materials, that'll just be a standard part of the thing. And really, it's a bubble. You know, all these extras, commentary tracks and everything, that's a bubble, basically. That's probably closing off, you know, except in rare cases. Again, higher profile projects and things like this. But you're not going to get, you know, the Saw 7 deluxe edition. Well, you might in that case. It's a cult film. Actually, there's a market for that in that case. But, you know, so that sort of thing where it was on every DVD release is going to go away, right? And so I think that's, again, one of those things where we assume is always going to be there. And no, it's not necessarily. And once things go just streaming, if that becomes dominant over downloads, then that closes that off. So.
But the great thing, like for David and I, and people who work in remastering things of that nature, is whether it's downloading, whether it's a physical DVD, whether it's streaming, whatever it is, you always have to create masters. So, you know, we're fortunate in that aspect that wherever it goes, we still have to be able to make it look good, make it sound good, and have that physical master that will then either go to a file or to a compression or whatever it may be. But you've always got to create that physical master that is remastered. And
yeah. And on our older shows, we've got it going back from 1-inch to DigiBeta to D2 to, you know, HD. We have all these versions of it that we keep in the archive because you just don't, you know, you can't get rid of anything. So.
Well, yes, as we're sort of feeling it again, the weight of all of these objects and different versions and iterations. I remember my first day at Warner Brothers seeing all the different versions of Gone with the Wind and almost fainted because they were like, yeah, get this copy. And I was like, what copy? I have no idea. So I'd like now, though, to be able to open this up to questions that you all might have. And I think we've got some microphones in the audience. Great.
Is it on?
No.
We'll be.
Here. Okay. Are we on now?
All right. Hi, thanks for a great panel. It was very thought-provoking. My question, with the end of the physical masters, and you just mentioned that we now have this big worry about the digital formats and migrating the digital formats, and then you mentioned having a physical video master for some of these newer shows that are now all digital rather than film. Could you talk a little bit more about that and what is happening right now? Because I know there are big issues in the film industry about keeping a master that can keep migrating, especially when they're layered with zillions of different effects. So in terms of television programs and CBS and Paramount, what's happening with some of the current shows in terms of the mastering?
Did everybody hear the question? Okay, good, just wanna make sure.
That's a great question. Ryan and I have had some meetings with the corporation, our corporation, to talk about like opening a migration department because it's so important as we may ask for tape backups for files that are being delivered, but yes, when do those tapes die? When are they gonna get QC'd? And if they start to disintegrate, you gotta make another copy. There's 4K, you know, 4K might be coming. And do we have to remaster stuff again? And how do you do that if you've already shot it on just HD? So those are discussions we're having since all of this medium is so new. of we've got to keep. LTOs are now not backwards compatible to a certain extent, so you're going to have audio soon maybe that you can't use anymore. You know, that's not acceptable. So we're definitely looking to having some kind of preservation and migration department, and we've been pushing for that.
Uh-oh, the chair.
Oh, boy.
You know, there's already a problem in terms of preservation. There's documentaries, really wonderful documentaries that friends of mine have made, and they, you know, were not brought up to DVD. They don't even have DVD copies themselves, and so they're already a generation or two and back. So I wonder sometimes about the commercial, you know, confluence with what's actually getting preserved or not. I was actually checking some of my favorite obscure TV shows to see if that actually been transferred. You know, like The Prisoner from the 1960s, which was the Twin Peaks of its time. But I've got a technical question for you guys. What do you do with things that don't have negative, like kinescopes from the golden age of television? I mean, because I've used kinescopes before, and they look horrible. I mean, you use them because you use them. But do you guys have a commercial use for, you know, that? I think CBS Playhouse is the 1960s, but there must have been a precursor in the 50s.
Well, we're working on a show right now, and you might have seen the later adaptation with Johnny Depp called Dark Shadows. Well, that came from a vampire soap opera that ran for a handful of years and did close to 300 episodes, but it was shot on kinescope. So we're actually going back, and luckily those kinescope tapes were transferred over to 2-inch and Digibeta and things of that nature. But in that case, you just take what you have and you make it the best that you can have. So I've spent a lot of time in the color correction bay trying to, you know, Dark Shadow started off black and white, and then it switched over to color. So we get in there and do our best to try and balance out the black and white, or go in there and, you know, add a little saturation, or do whatever we can to just make it as pretty as possible. But in a lot of cases, the line fill dropouts, you know, there's certain things that are inherent with kinescope that will still be inherent in our new masters, but they will be the best that they can be based on what that source is.
And we also have an area at CBS, and I think more and more companies will be opening up, that we keep a machine of everything that we can, and we call it Jurassic Park. And I really think that in Hollywood or the United States, there will be companies that literally will be opening up. It'll be the Mad Max of post-production, that you'll go to them because they have one of everything.
They already exist.
Yeah.
There are those companies.
Okay, yeah.
There are basically two places you can go for 2-inch. Transfers right now,
right.
In the country, the entire country. Right. So it's here, and I think it will probably develop.
Right. And we had a whole discussion, which we won't get into last night, about film and 35 going out and 16, and where do you get that trend? Yes.
We can't even go down that path. There's a hand back right there. Is there a microphone over here? I don't think so. No.
Hey guys. All right. So I'm kind of confused on how a digital file could be corrupted in a way. So like, if you have audio on a master on a tape, obviously, like if the humidity changes, that can change the audio. But if you have like wave files on a hard drive, what are some ways that can corrupt over time? Do you know?
Basically, the hard drive itself. I mean, I don't do a lot with computers myself, but I mean, a lot of people whose hard drives have crashed and things have happened, and a lot of times it just goes back to exactly that. A lot of these platforms are delicate platforms. So if it's being stored in a certain way, you know, I mean, that gets a little more techy than what I do, but I'd see it happen, and then it ends up on our desk to do what we can to fix it. But it does happen, and whatever those instances may be. But I do know in terms of files and things like that, it can just be simply the way that file is being stored and the hard drive that it's stored on and things like that.
I was going to add to that, just in terms of digital degradation too, that they're just finding out now, you know, well, when the CD first came out, let's say to take CDs as a format, and then even DVD, the same thing. There's no kind of rhyme or reason so far. They're trying to determine which coatings successfully protect them and which don't. And actually, even totally identical discs that came from the same plant and everything, they'll run tests on them, you know, stress tests. One will fail and one will be perfectly fine. And so that's the frustrating and scary thing about that. You know, you may be able to play that disc you may not be able to. And the same with the hard drives and everything. That and as complex as those files too. I mean, that's the other thing too. That these aren't like little JPEGs or something. You know, these are immensely complicated files, and it just takes a little bit of corruption in there, and it's just unusable.
So. Yeah, I mean, when we have it on, yes, brand new stuff. We have DVD releases that go out, and every studio does, and it doesn't play for some reason. And sometimes it's a player issue, sometimes it's not. We've run into where we cannot figure out why this brand new disc cannot play somewhere.
Is this not on at all? Oh, here we go. Wonderful. So when you showed the clips, there's no question those are very technically impressive, that you developed this great set of restoration skills. But obviously, depending on the audience, they might respond to the results of that differently. And I'm thinking specifically of the music licensing example, in the fact that you're showing off your ability to, you know, cut this out and provide a sound alike that matches relatively well with the movements, and we're all sitting here thinking you're stripping away the original authentic music choice. And so there, you're not pitching that to us as an audience of sort of TV scholars and people who do this work. You're pitching that to the people who are paying for this, who don't want to pay the music rights for the Beach Boys and want to know that you can still maintain some degree of integrity of the original program in that context. So I'm sort of wondering, you obviously sort of spoke earlier, you want to get it out to fans within the financial limitations you have, but sort of at what point do you make those calls of what you cut, what you don't cut, and like how exactly does that line, which is obviously a moving line, land when you actually go into these programs and go into those relationships?
Great question. And we're doing two things. We're doing one for the fans and one for that heritage, for that asset protection. Like take Happy Days season 6 that we're working on right now. Chock full of Chuck Berry, Elvis, all those cues that are just through the roof, crazy expensive. However, when we're doing our remastering, we start with doing a remastering of the original network series. So we're remastering it with every one of those cues in there so that we have our asset protection master, so we have our heritage master, as Carolyn would call it, that we have up on the shelf, and it's done completely original. Now, we'll go in. Now, part of what we do, too, is we just don't go in there, and he and I are very passionate about this. We're not butchers. So we'll literally, I look at every replacement that's put up for replacement, because what will happen is we'll get a list from legal, basically, and says, look, here's all the unclearable cues, here are all the cues that are too expensive, here are all the ones that we want you to go and evaluate for replacement. So I'll look at every single scene, every single cue, and I'll report back to them and go, okay, you know what, in this case, it's background jukebox music. Yeah, it's cool to have Chuck Berry or Elvis or, you know, or whoever it may be. However, we can't really afford it. So for these ones, I would say, yes, we can find a great sound alike and put it in there for the consumer product that we're putting out on the street. In a lot of cases, like, you know, we just had a horrible death in the film and entertainment community with Robin Williams, and we're working on Mork and Mindy season 4 right now. Well, I looked at those, and there's certain cases going, look, we can't go in there and cut up Robin Williams or I Love Lucy. We, you know, Lucy sings these songs and Ricky's singing Babaloo. Well, we're not going to go in there and cut out Ricky Ricardo singing Babaloo. So we'll report back to them and say, these are all the ones that we truly think you should keep. Let's figure out a way to keep them. These are the ones that we can get rid of without hurting the scene or the integrity of the series itself, for that matter. And then we have both those copies. So we have that network original, and then we also have the one that we go in and we work on. And in a lot of cases, there'll be scenes where I'll be on the mixing stage, and I'm like, oh, this just, it's not playing right. It doesn't feel right. I don't want to put this one out. So we'll actually go back in, and we'll, like the, which one was it we were looking at? One of these in here. Oh, it was the Happy Days one, where it was the Beach Boys song. Well, we couldn't find, and because we've got the dance and the doing that thing, we couldn't find a cue that worked really well out of the vast libraries that we had. So we actually had somebody compose that cue for us so that they could get the beat, so that they could get the movement. So we really do put our passion into the replacements that we do, but we always make sure that we have that original network that we can go back to as well. So we're trying to cover both bases.
And a lot of it comes down to the rights. So if the rights were cleared for music for broadcast in perpetuity, you're always going to see it in whatever market it was cleared. Now, as we get these streaming and all these new markets, deals for Happy Days never existed. So that's where the problem comes in. So on certain markets, we have to make those changes, but it's not in every market, because some of them have been cleared in the past for that market in perpetuity.
Does that help answer that?
Yes. Are we
following? Hi, I'm following up on that. I'm someone who studies music on television historically, and have tons of questions, but I will only ask in relation to that. First of all, how might a scholar be able to see the original archival copy? Because if you're trying to trace, as a scholar, trace the history of music on television, I don't want to be seeing some stream of Happy Days with replaced music. I want to hear the Beach Boys. I want to hear Buddy Holly. My second question is, and I don't think this is really for you, but it's possibly something that could go back to legal departments. Now music is being used in even more interesting ways as part of narrative, as very important pieces of the series. How are we going to prevent that sort of thing from being stripped out and totally altering the text? And I'll catch you with my other questions later.
Well, the good part about that second one, I'll let David answer the first one about how a scholar would go about getting a copy, because I'm sure that there are ways for that to obviously happen. Yeah, exactly. But in terms of... With the legal departments now, we run into this a lot with the older shows because, like David was saying, deals were never in place. So things that we're creating now, those deals are in place. I mean, just even shows that I worked on, 15 years ago, we didn't have those type of deals in place. But the newer shows, hopefully those deals are, everything's being in perpetuity throughout the universe, space stations, everything, so that it is covered.
I would just add maybe in terms of the access issue. There's a model for this if you look to what's happened with film and you look at some of the negotiations that are going on, I think probably you all are aware, with institutions like the Library of Congress and some like Paramount, CBS, a number of companies where you'll have those originals at some point deposited in a public collection so that there is this kind of public-private partnership that develops in order to answer those kinds of issues or those kinds of scholarly questions. I would say polemically, though, the difficulty to gain access in a public institution sometimes is harder than it would be in a private companies because you have major institutions that are increasingly losing funding and an increased demand. So I think there's kind of an interesting issue here in terms of scholarship, scholars coming together to say, this is really valuable, we need to privilege this at institutions, at public institutions across the country, not just the Library of Congress, not just in Washington, D.C., but indeed across the country. So that was my jumping in to galvanize the forces. And you can always deposit anything you want with us here at UT.
Right? You are so
just
kind.
Just go ahead. Bring it.
Okay. I have some stuff in the trunk. And you guys, I think, are more attuned to answer this question, but I know there are things, and I'm not that close to it, so I know there's the Paley Center. I know there's the Television Museum. I don't know, and you guys probably do they give access to people online to look at things? And
It depends on which collections and everything, and again, which rights actually were granted to them. So that, just like you said, with legal about music clearances for commercial use and everything, it'd be the same kind of thing about what the rights for public use are. And we were just talking about, we don't want to name the school we were talking about yesterday, but basically the number of films they have in their collection, but not knowing if they've got the public exhibition rights to them, right? So they may have the assets, but they might not have the rights to use them or the digital distribution rights to them and everything. And so it does become... that point, just to go to Norma's question, it does become, you're really stuck there and they have the assets, but you can't actually access them or use them because a deal wasn't struck to be able to, go back and see them in that way.
Are any of these things just viewable to the public?
Oh, yeah. I mean, a lot of them are. In the Paley Center and UCLA and other archives will have, digital stations. You can go in there and see them. And even if it's more limited resources, if you give them notice ahead of time, they can set up special screenings and things like that for that. But there may be even some materials that, you might be able to look at sort of one-on-one, but if you wanted to take that, let's say that Happy Days episode, and, can I have a copy of that? No. Can I show that to my class? No. You might not be legally able to do that. And so that's where the barriers still are.
We actually just over the last couple of years encountered an interesting thing where a major university in Los Angeles which everyone gave their films to as a nice gesture that people could use them and see them and whatever, are now charging. And even for us to go back to get the copyright that we have, we are now being charged to go. And it's a shame because I understand the dilemma, but people are going to start to find other ways, as anyone does.
So you spend money on restoring these shows and putting them on DVD because the fans want it, but then what happens when fan interest dries up and the DVD box sets start to go away? Do we keep an eye on these shows? Do we let them rot? Which I guess is just my roundabout way of saying, can we please have the complete series of MASH on Blu-ray?
Wrong studio, but yes, that was one of my favorite shows. I actually tried to write a script for them, and they liked it, but they said they didn't do the certain thing. That's funny you bring up. I love that show. I would love to have MASH too. And a lot of times it really is the fans that will hound the studios or whatever to bring it back to light. I mean, there's been TV shows that have gone off the air, and the fans have gone crazy and it's shown up on a cable thing or even back on the network.
So we could take this to the streets, is what we're saying here. If this group would like to get together, sign a petition, we'll take it back to CBS.
And we do utilize, I'm sorry to cut you off, but we do utilize social media a lot in that aspect, because Dave and I are the two that will oftentimes go to sales and the various upper management that approve these things, and we'll use Facebook and things of that nature and go, look, this show has 1.7 million followers. Even if 200,000 of them will buy this, we'll make a profit, or we'll do the math to see if we have a profit and loss and things like that. So we do try and track things, especially once we've started, we started on Beverly Hillbillies because the fans wanted it. And those sales did start to dry up. But we're, just now after a couple of years later, we're hitting it back again. And we have sales departments. We'll go to the territories and go, we're just going to check again. Was there an interest in that? And we talked about it last night, but a lot of times you guys and what you're watching and what we're all watching today, contemporary shows, becomes very relevant to what we're doing. So right now shows like Justified and Longmire and these shows that have kind of a cool Hell on Wheels and, Sons of Anarchy, the Outlaw is back. So there's a cool vibe about the Outlaw. So we're going back to things like Rawhide and Maverick and things of that nature that have that same kind of cool old nostalgic vibe and trying to parlay the two together. So we do everything we can to keep it all going. And once we start, we really do, our goal is to get that complete series box set.
And a lot of times people probably think, well, they're only going to put something out because they know they're going to have a profit in it, which is actually not true at CBS. We many times with the DVD department, they will put out a season of something not knowing how it's going to do. They hope it's going to do well. And we also have Make On Demand with Amazon. And I think it was Barnaby Jones or something where we were shocked. We did this Make On Demand thing. We thought, okay, we're going to do it. The fans went crazy. And we're like, wow, okay, who knew? And we started putting out more seasons. So sometimes they will test the waters when they're not
Matlock.
Sure. Maybe it was Matlock.
I think it was Matlock with Andy Griffith.
Yeah. Hello, Matlock. I think we've got just an eye on the time. Oh, I think we've got maybe, here, you jump in, and then
real
one
quick,
more question.
Sometimes it's a title-specific thing and everything. I mean, Batman was a case for years and years and years. The fans were just desperately, we want our Batman. And it was just a matter of getting Fox and Warner Brothers to figure out a way, who's going to profit the most from this. So my guess is with the case with MASH, the syndication history of this is that there has been disputes between Alan Alda and Fox on the way that show has been distributed on cable and on DVD. And so that may be, because he's a producer of the show, right? He was one of the producers of the show. So that may be one of the things that's holding it up, actually, that there could be a legal thing that's, contentious.
Always legal.
Yeah, always.
So I think just one more question. I'm not sure where the mics are. Oh, done. Kathy.
Yeah.
Kathy will just yell.
I'm coming, Kathy.
I'm just curious what examples of things that are irretrievably gone. What's the worst? Because I know, say, Johnny Carson episodes are mostly all gone. My guess is Captain Kangaroo from CBS, gone. What's the worst that's gone?
Well, very quickly, it's funny you bring up Captain Kangaroo because, 6 months ago, a year ago, get a call from our archive department that whoever is the broker of Captain Kangaroo is looking to sell it. And our licensing department was like, okay, get some over here. We want to look at them, see what kind of, we get them over there. Ryan and I go down and look at them. They've got a bunch of dropouts and this and that, but like, no, they're playable and stuff. We now have Captain Kangaroo, and we are trying to archive it because it's a mess, and we're trying to figure out what we would do with it. I think you can probably speak to some of this too.
Oh, in terms of what's missing and everything. Yeah, well, that's the thing. Sometimes you don't know what's missing. And the Tonight Show is a great example of this. As far as I know, the Carson estate controls most of the rights for that and not NBC. And so they're actually parsing that out.
It's all online now.
Yeah,
It's all online. You can actually access it. It was launched, I think, 2 years ago. And a little trivia. And I say this partly with a lot of scholars in the room. The number one user of the Carson collection are people whose family members appeared on the show, not scholars. And I think there's something really important about that because
that's literally heritage, right?
Yeah, it is. Yeah. And I think that over time, this would be my way of kind of posing a personal question: is over time, is it really a genealogical quest in the end? Because once the nostalgia factor is over, once that connection to certain shows is over, is it really going to be my great grandfather was actually on Maverick, and I'd really like to get an episode? That's not going to drive sales, right? So I think there's some interesting questions, but the Carson Project is a really interesting one because they did it all on their own. Because of rights. So, but I'd like to thank everyone for coming today and our panelists. Thank you so much. I'm sure we'd be glad to answer some questions. If a few of you didn't get a chance, you're welcome to come up to the stage. Thanks.
Thanks, everybody.